Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Sundress. Writer Kurt Busiek has been a fan favorite for decades on both his takes on mainstream characters and teams like the Avengers and the Justice League, plus his original concepts like Astro City, co-created with artists Brent Anderson and Alex Ross, and the World War I miniseries Aerosmith with artist Carlos Pacheco. Currently, he's putting a new spin on Aquaman with artist Jackson Geist and Superman in collaboration with co-writer Jeff Johns and artist Pete Woods. Our conversation begins with a look at the 8-part Superman story going on now in the Superman Monthly and Action Comics. First, let me ask, co-writing with Jeff, I just had Alan Heinberg on, and he talked about writing with Jeff for JLA. Are you guys doing this, you know, just through email and phone conversations? Are you ever together to talk about these ideas?
We started out that way. What we did was last September, Jeff flew up here, and we installed him in the guest room for 3 days, I think. And so we, you know, hung around in my office and talked Superman all day. The first day, we just talked about cool ideas that should be in there, stuff we wanted to get across, general stuff, scenes, bits and pieces. And then we went out to dinner with Pete Woods, who lives out here, and talked about cool stuff. The next day, we hammered out an outline, putting the various things we'd come up with the previous day together into an 8-issue outline, and we had a few holes left. By the time we got to work the next day, we'd each had time to sleep on it, we figured out how to fill the holes. So those 3 days of being in the same room and just hammering on this stuff was a real boon. Jeff typed up an 8-issue outline. I tweaked it here and there. We sent it into DC, and they approved it. From that point on, the way it's generally worked is we'll have a phone conversation about the plot of an issue, fleshing out what we had in the outline. One of us will type it up. The other one will tweak it here and there. That'll go to Pete to draw. Then I do the first pass script, and Jeff tweaks it here and there. We fight over anything we don't agree on, which really isn't all that much. And that's how it gets done. So it's a lot of fun. Jeff is not only a terrific writer, but he's one of the most enthusiastic collaborators I've ever met. He's open to different ideas. He's full of energy and just makes the whole experience a really positive one.
Does it feel like when you read the finished product, your voice, or is it a voice that is different from yours due to the collaboration?
Because I'm doing the first pass of the final script, it does feel to me more like my voice, because most of the words that hit the page are mine.
Mm-hmm.
Generally what happens is Jeff will change a couple of things here and there, and he'll cut 7 balloons or so throughout the script. he'll just say, cut this, cut this, cut this, and I'll look at the cut and go, I guess we didn't need it at that after all.
Okay.
So I'm actually trying to learn to do that for myself, and I'll write the script and then go in and look and say, what don't we need? but the speech patterns of the characters and the pacing on the page and all, the surface stuff is largely coming from me, so it does feel pretty much like me.
I really enjoyed Secret Identity, and I'm glad that you've had a chance to get back to Superman, because I think Superman sometimes gets a bad rep from writers who don't understand how to write the character. And I think you're luckily an exception to that. You clearly get the guy. And what I like is, well, tell me what you think you get about Superman.
It's funny that you ask, because up until Secret Identity, I didn't get the guy.
Okay.
I had ideas for what I might do in Superman stories, but they were all about the adventure. Who's he going to hit? What's the complication going to be? What's a cool villain idea? And not about the character and who he is. And writing Superman's Secret Identity, which, you know, doesn't have any supervillains in it.
No.
And doesn't have any big action sequences. It's all character. Gave me a different window on Superman. In part, it was this guy actually isn't Superman, but the fact that he has the superpowers, that he has this secret, puts himself at a remove from humanity, that that whoever he sees, whoever he contacts, whoever he's in touch with, he's not fully sharing himself with them, except maybe with his wife.
Right.
But that makes him a little bit alienated, that when he doesn't know what to do, he goes and sits in the sky and thinks, or he goes and walks around on the moon or the bottom of the ocean and tries to figure things out from an outsider's perspective. And the funny part about that is it's these powers that make him alienated, but I think the basic state of humanity is alienation, that all of us feel alone and disconnected somehow.
Yes.
and our efforts in life are in some way a reaction to that. So the fact that the real Superman is an actual alien as opposed to alienated, that distance that he feels from the world, in his case it's real, in everyone else's case it's kind of, you know, psychological, metaphorical, but the fact that Superman feels like he's not quite human is what makes him human, because we all feel that way.
And it's interesting then, because in your story, especially right now that it's only two issues old, the Clark Kent side of the persona comes through, and it's the side of Superman that I'm so glad to see again, that really I think you're handling it, you and Jeff, in a way that I haven't seen since the early 70s when Elliot Magin was writing things like The Private Life of Clark Kent, where you really feel like Clark is a fully realized character outside of the Superman persona, and it's nice to see Clark Kent solving problems, or Clark Kent and how he handles a crisis without the Superman powers.
Well, some of that may come from the fact that, you know, I've read all those old Elliot Magin stories, and Marty Pascoe, I thought,
yep,
he also did a lot with Clark, specifically with Clark and Lois and Lana, and Kerry Bates was doing great stuff at that time, too. But part of it is also that since we started out with Superman depowered, he is human.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets to be human. That distance, that barrier between him and the rest of the world just isn't there. And he's liking it.
Yeah, yeah.
So part of that is, you know, because of the circumstances of the story going on, we get more space than you ordinarily get to explore Clark. So let's have fun. Let's do that. And part of it is, you know, let's see Clark really, really being human, so when the powers come back, you can see the transition, you can see the change, you can see him having to readjust to, no, this is who I really am.
It's funny, because 20 years ago, I think the edict from DC and that John Byrne had was, let's strip away all of the Weisinger era and Julie Schwartz era trappings that had gotten to be old hat, I guess, by the mid-80s. And now you and Jeff and Grant Morrison as well in All-Star Superman are evoking the fun of the Weisinger and Schwartz eras, but in a contemporary setting. And it's wild, because I think Pete, for example, on your guys' story, is doing a great job. And I'm a big Pete fan, even back in the Catwoman days. And I would say the same with Frank Quietly. But I could easily see Kurt Swan or Murphy Anderson doing your guys' stories, and them being, again, these wonderful stories that kind of hit that vibe of all the fun parts of those earlier eras, but in a contemporary setting.
There's a lot of, you know, to a great degree, we're doing that deliberately. I don't think that it was the wrong choice back in 1985,
mm-hmm,
to make a big change, to strip some of this stuff away, but again, you know, that was 20 years ago.
Right.
And I don't think it's a wrong choice now to pull apart what we've had for the last 20 years and rebuild it differently. I think Superman needs to be refreshed every now and then.
Sure.
That, you know, the Golden Age Superman was basically 1938 to around 57, 58.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Weisinger era came into full bloom, and we had the Superman family, and we had, you know, Kandor and the Phantom Zone and all of this stuff. And that lasted, you know, if that lasted 20 years up till 78, that would have been a hellaciously good era of Superman. It lasted until 1985, which was probably a few years too long.
Sure.
And then, you know, John reinvigorated Superman for that era, and we've had 20 years for that. And now Jeff and I, in Up, Up, and Away, are getting to dig into it and pull it apart and put it back together again. And all of those silver and Bronze Age elements that were discarded back in 1985 aren't old hat anymore, because you know many of the people reading the books today have never seen them.
You bet.
You know, longtime fans, they're familiar with them, but they haven't seen them in a long time. But the very fact that we've had that break allows us to bring them in a different way. Instead of saying, well, yeah, this is what it looks like because that's what was designed in 1962, we get to say, well, if we're going to bring in an element from the past, we get to say, what would that be like if it was created now?
Sure.
How can we make it look, you know, how can we have the strength of that concept, that idea, that cool element, whatever it is, but today, instead of it's the return of something that looks like it belongs in 1964.
It's fun to see everything back with a new twist, and it makes you smile. Even the simplest thing, like, you know, in the last issue, Green Lantern giving Clark a ring and having Clark, you know, with the green energy and everything. Like I said, it's a wonderful image. Pete makes it different, and again, you're able to really put in a little more dialogue for an older audience, where it works, and it's fresh again.
Well, thanks very much.
And obviously you have so much to say with Superman that I guess with what's going on with action being delayed, you're able to build on up in a way than with Fabian Nicieza.
Nicieza,
thank you.
Yeah, I when action was delayed and there was this 3-month gap that needed to be filled somehow, one of the first things that I said, you know, even before I knew what story we were going to do, was I'll do that. you know, part of my reasoning was I've got 9 million Superman ideas. You know, ever since I clicked into who the guy is and what goes on inside his head, I've just been having ideas faster than I'll ever be able to use them up. So the big action part of this story is a plot line that I had planned that, you know, maybe we'd get to a year, 2 years down the line, but I don't have room for it before that. And the idea that we could take this big action adventure and make it a direct follow-on to Up, Up, and Away by, you know, having the world basically ask the question, okay, Superman's back, but, you know, the last time he came back, he was four different guys and they were all fakes. So it's very nice, Metropolis, that you think you got your hero back, but is he real? And that allows us to do a story that explores the Superman's place in the DC universe, Superman's place in the public eye. Up, Up, and Away is very much about his immediate stage, about Metropolis and the planet, and that sort of thing. Back in Action is the trilogy where we take it out to a global basis and see how his return affects things there.
All your stories come in various sizes. I mean, you're great at doing a single-issue one and done, as you showed in things like Astro City Local Heroes for the most part, and, you know, then to what you're doing now with Jeff and your follow-up with 3 issues as well. Do you have a favored length that you're used to mostly writing in?
No.
Okay.
I like writing single-issue stories. I like writing big Mama Jama epics. I have no particular, you know, when I write a story, I think of it at this length because I like the variety. You know,
sure.
If you're doing a story about, you know, 900-foot-tall armored alien who's crashing around on Earth, it's probably going to take more, you know, more space than if you're writing a story about Jimmy Olsen dealing with the fact that his life is crap these days, purely on the visual sense. You know, one of the great things about Superman, I mean, even back in the Silver Age, is that, you know, some issues you'd get that giant 3-part complete in one issue novel that spreads across the universe and it has earth-shaking events, and in the next issue you've got a 7-page story about fighting gangsters that's got some interesting character portraits and twists to it. Superman, you know, because Superman is so powerful, it's not big action adventure over and over again. It's action adventure salted in with character stuff. And it's the character stuff that makes you come back over and over again.
You bet.
And so, you know, that's the kind of stories that that I want to tell, you know, along with the big adventure. It's got to have that variety or it's just going to get dull.
Let's move to Aquaman. I like the direction that you've gone in. It was not a book that I intended to get, but, I mean, the combination of you and Butch Geist sounded too good to be true, and what clearly is a big mystery and will take a while to solve started with so much story in that first issue. You laid out a very detailed and dense first issue of this is who this guy is, this is the quest that he's about to take. I like it.
I firmly believe that you better give people a reason in issue one to come back. When we did Thunderbolts, it was all about building up to that big sting at the end.
Yeah.
Because that was the moment that was going to make people say, I get it. I see what this series is about. I want to, you know, I'll be back every month. In Aquaman Sword of Atlantis, it was, yeah, we had to show you who the new guy was. We had to show you what the situation was. We had to show you what he was wrestling with, and we had to get to that moment at the end that says, okay, the wizard has just outlined all of this stuff that's supposed to happen in the future, but look, he's wrong. So that gets you to the point where you go, well, what's going to happen now? You know, if a hero goes off on a quest to accomplish a bunch of stuff that was actually accomplished years ago, well, what happens then? And I think that's the point where we've got an audience going, I don't know what's going to go on here. And that's the place that I love to have readers in. I love to have the audience in a place where they can't imagine what's coming.
Well, I think I'm among a lot of people that are enjoying the mystery. I know the first issue sold out. I don't know about the second one.
I haven't heard that the second one sold out, but I gather that the orders got boosted when retailers saw how well the first issue did and put in orders for that second printing. I think they bumped up their orders for the second issue.
And, you know, I liked Will Pfeiffer's run on Aquaman, and I liked what John Accurdi and John Ostrander had both done with the character as well. It's neat to see, though, that you get to start with Arthur Curry, but a clean-slated Arthur Curry that isn't Aquaman yet.
Yeah, that's a part of the big plan there. I mean, I thought Sub Diego was an interesting concept, too, but unfortunately it didn't work. You know, the book was canceled.
Sure.
And whether that was because people didn't like the idea or they didn't like the delivery of the idea or what, it doesn't really matter. You know, what I had to deal with coming into it is this didn't work. You know, there are a lot of readers out there who would like to see Sub Diego continue and just fix it. And the trouble with that is even if you fixed it, even if you made it something readers would love, they already gave up. They're already gone, and they're not coming back unless you give them a reason to come back that's more than, it's the same idea you saw before, but we're hopefully doing it in a more compelling manner now. You know, I think the Arcudi run was pretty damn good.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, readers were just slipping away, and the book was going to be canceled when they handed it to me and said, what can you do to save this? So, you know, I had a couple of lengthy conversations with Dan DiDio just talking about why each of us thought Aquaman hadn't worked in the past, what were the best runs, what were the most troubled runs, what were the reasons that it wasn't able to maintain fan interest. And I ended up, I think, throwing two or three ideas at him that we ended up piling all into the, you know, into one thing. One of the things I said was that I'd been playing around with the idea that if someday I did like All-Star Aquaman, it would be fun to go back to the beginning, to go back to a guy who hasn't won everything there is to win and is the undisputed king of the sea and you know, is trapped in this cycle of I get the throne back, I get my queen back, and then I'm happy, so they kick me out, so I've got drama, and I go on some sort of quest, and then sales dip, and so I get my throne back, and I get my queen back, and it starts all over again.
Sure.
The Golden Age Aquaman, the original Aquaman, had, you know, he wasn't from Atlantis at all. He was a human being whose father had given him these abilities to breathe underwater. And in his world, Atlantis was just a ruin. But I said, if you take somebody like that, a new guy who's just not part of his undersea world, and you drop him into the middle of this exotic fantasy setting with hidden races and monsters and wizards and kingdoms and all, then you get to see it through his eyes, and you get to see it as a realm of fantastic wonder instead of, oh, yeah. I've been here for years. This isn't special to me anymore.
You bet. No, a fish out of water, if you will, in terms of who this Aquaman is. This is, I mean, he was.
Right, yeah, he's. I guess he's a fish in the water.
Exactly. Well, and a very Edgar Rice Burroughs and Robert Howard feel to these stories. I get a John Carter vibe as much as I do a Conan vibe, and I was going to ask if your run on Conan maybe had your mind, you know, open to this kind of possibility for Aquaman.
Oh, definitely. I had thought for years that Aquaman should be a fantasy book rather than a superhero book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, give it some superhero stuff here and there, but the main thrust of it is brave warrior in a fantastic world more than it is crime fighter. It was writing Conan that made me say, boy, writing this sort of thing is fun. I want to do more of this. And when I was offered the exclusive at DC, one of the things I thought of was, what DC properties are there that could be sword and sorcery, heroic adventure as much or more than superheroes? And when we started talking about Aquaman, that was one of the things that I threw into the mix.
That's cool.
I actually hadn't really gotten the sense of a John Carter vibe, although I can see why people think that. I'd been thinking, you know, part Conan, part Lord of the Rings, part King Arthur.
Sure.
With you know, the young hero with a destiny. Certainly the young hero with a mysterious and cranky sorcerer.
Mm-hmm.
Advising him is very, you know,
Arthurian
tone.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's that, and there's I'm a big fan of David Gemmell's heroic fantasy novels.
Okay.
And there's a big heaping helping of Gemmell style fantasy salted in there too, and it's just, you know, working through the influences, working toward a big fantastic story that does have the traditional Aquaman elements, albeit in a, you know, reinterpreted in a different way. It's a lot of fun, and man, Butch Geist is doing a gorgeous job, isn't he?
He's a classic, and he has been for decades, and wonderful to see him on this kind of book where he can really stretch. And, you know, it's not a period piece, but, you know, it's a fantasy piece, so he gets to really kind of stretch and do some fun genre moves. It's neat. Last year, I really felt DC missed an opportunity because of the inadvertent promotion for Entourage, the HBO show, and it was fun, and it really was. And I always felt like, I'm like, oh man. And I told Will, I was like, man, you missed out, man. That was your window. It's too bad that you weren't aware of it. Do you know, as a writer, or did you even inquire to say if Entourage is going to stick with any type of Aquaman vibe?
I really don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I think Entourage has certainly put Aquaman into the forefront in its way. I think Brad Meltzer pointed out that, you know, if you've got a popular HBO series, or it is HBO, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That keeps on hammering on, we're making an Aquaman movie, we're making an Aquaman movie, even if they're doing it for comedy, you know that there are 12 producers in Hollywood at least going, well, could we?
Well, and two, I guess Warner is has got the TV show in development.
Yeah, and I've got to think that, you know, it wasn't simply the success of Smallville, but it was the success of Smallville and the buzz from Entourage.
I think you're right.
That had them say, no, we got to do this. We got to do this. We got to take a shot at it. And apparently the pilots come out well. So to answer your question, I had no idea that there was a TV show in the works. When I pitched a younger Aquaman, I am assuming that when Dan DiDio heard the words younger Aquaman, part of the reason he lit up was because he knew there was a TV series in the works, but I didn't. So I'm delighted that there is an Aquaman TV series in the works, that Entourage was going around, you know, saying, hey, Aquaman, let's get this into the zeitgeist.
Sure.
I can't think that does anything but help me, but we're not, you know, we're not counting on it. We're not trying to do an adaptation of any of that stuff. We're just hoping that that sort of thing will get people to look at Aquaman, and then they'll read the comic and they'll say, "Hey, this is good. I want to keep reading it on its own merits." I have noticed that in some newspaper columns. We've been getting articles about you know, Aquaman's got buzz again, and they mentioned the Smallville spinoff show, mm-hmm. and they mentioned Entourage, and they mentioned the new comic. So I guess the guys at DC are making hay with that and using it to get some ink and some promotion for the comic. And I'll take it.
You bet. Are there, as a guy who's written various incarnations of the Justice League and of the Avengers as well, and tons of teen books, do you think there are certain, for lack of better words, B and C heroes that, you know, are brought back, and you try to make a monthly with some of these guys, and some succeed, some fail? Do you think there are just some characters that can't sustain an ongoing title just because they're better as a sideline character rather than the main focus in their own books?
I think there are. I don't think Aquaman's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that somebody like the Vision would be very difficult to do as an ongoing series.
Okay.
Because the Vision, you know, the Vision thrives in a team setting as somebody who's, you know, the reserved and logical guy whose personality bounces off the, you know, the inspiring leader and the smart mouth jerk and the whatever, you know, he's got a real solid place in an ensemble cast.
Sure.
Aquaman, you know, Aquaman's all about the undersea world and the kingdom and all. You put him in a group, and it's just like, ah, the super friends are going off to fight this and that, and Aquaman's at the docks fighting the guys who are trying to steal something at the docks so that he can bring in the fish. You know, it's actually difficult to fit Aquaman into a team setting unless that team setting is one that will get you to the damn ocean every now and then. So you know, you keep him out of the ocean, and he's, you know, commanding strong guy. Justice League's got a fair number of commanding strong guys. You put him in the ocean, and what does he need them for? He can do it all by himself. And there are only so many stories where you can fight crime at the docks. So I actually think, you know, the biggest problem with Aquaman in terms of the Justice League and all is that Aquaman is about his environment.
Sure.
Aquaman is the guy who breathes underwater and talks to fish. And when you put that in the Justice League, it sounds a little silly, talking to fish. That's not much of a power compared to running at the speed of light. However, if you put that in a fantasy adventure setting, it's a terrific power. You know, if you're swimming around on quests and something, and you can say, "Oh, the fish over the hill are disturbed by something," or you can say, "There's a big wall here with a gate, but I'm going to throw 19 whales at it." That's pretty darn cool. If they could do that sort of thing in Lord of the Rings, they'd have had a lot less trouble with Sauron. So Aquaman's powers, his personality, his outlook, it all seems to work really, really well in the environment he's designed for. And when you take him out of it, you've got to build the stories around him, or he looks like a fifth wheel.
Sure, sure. And I like your idea that I've seen conveyed so far in the two issues, but also in interviews that you've done, that you're going to treat underwater almost like outer space and have that kind of backdrop of weirdness, and that will play in as much as the fantasy will play into it.
Yep. Yeah, that was actually my editor's reaction. You know, I had been commenting that the early Aquaman stories are essentially fantasy stories in an exotic setting. And he said, you know, the early Silver Age Aquaman stories, at least, are pretty much of the same stripe as DC's space adventure stories of the
yes.
same time. It's just that instead of look at this race of weird aliens, it's look at this race of weird undersea people. but other than that, the formulas follow that same pattern. They were adventure stories more than they were superheroes. And I think that that in both cases we're reacting to the same thing, which is it's the story of an adventure character in an exotic land, whether that land is in outer space or underwater or a fantasy world, or as some people have noted, Aquaman stories kind of easily compare to westerns.
Oh, that's cool.
Because, you know, you're talking about a lawless land.
Sure.
In Superman, you know, one of the questions you always have to answer is why don't the cops take care of it? And the answer is usually a pretty simple one, which is it's too powerful for them.
You bet.
But, you know, go to Batman, go to Blue Beetle, you know, it's just what about the authority structures of the world? Why do we need a superhero to deal with this? Because they're not up to it. In the case of Aquaman, particularly, one of the things I'm doing is saying, the authority structure got stepped on by the Spectre.
That's right.
So, you know, there ain't no law under the Atlantic. There is only the strength of your good right arm and what you can, what you can accomplish on your own. And that is a world that does feel a little more like the Wild West, or that feels a little more like King Arthur, or that feels a little bit more like, you know, as you mentioned, John Carter. It's not Metropolis. It's not Gotham City. It's not like them. It's a whole different kind of stage.
You've written so many of the mainstream DC and Marvel characters. Is there one of the frontline guys that you can't wrap your head around? Like some people have trouble with Superman, for example?
That I can't wrap my head around. I don't know. I mean, there are guys who I
you've touched everybody pretty much in Avengers and JLA.
Yeah, but touching them and writing them
yeah.
as themselves are different things.
Mm-hmm.
I've written the Fantastic Four in that I've had the Fantastic Four show up in the Avengers,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't been able to chart their adventures and change their world and see what develops with them. Whenever I write them, they're guest stars, and I'm writing somebody else's version of their status quo at the moment.
Okay.
So, you know, there are characters I'd love to write. I'd love to write Green Lantern. I'd love to write Wonder Woman someday. I'm dying to write a Barry Allen Flash story eventually. But I've written all those characters.
I gotcha.
I've generally written them in team-up stories.
And are those options available to you when your schedule allows it, as far as guys like DiDio are concerned?
I would figure that if I went in there and I said I've got an 8-issue Barry Allen miniseries that I want to do, Dan would be interested and would find a way to do it. And I certainly hope that's the case, because someday I will do that.
Cool.
I want to write Hal Jordan. I think if I went in and said that now, I'd get this blank look and be told, Jeff Johns is writing Hal Jordan. but maybe, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, when Jeff has had his fill, then maybe I can be the next guy, or whatever.
You came to them with the Aquaman pitch. Go ahead.
They came to me with the, we need somebody to rethink and save Aquaman.
Okay.
Dan actually had an idea for the book. And I said, well, I'll do my best with it. And I thought about it for a while, but I didn't think Dan's idea would work. So I pitched him a different idea that Dan didn't like. And that's what started us on the long phone calls that ultimately got us where we're going. So they came to me with Aquaman. And while I'm the guy who came up with what we're actually doing with it, it's not as if I thought it up in a vacuum and called them up and said, hey, I hear Aquaman's available.
Okay, I was wondering how much of what has been planned for Crisis for 52 was like presented to you when taking over these books. Obviously, Superman was probably had a few more fingerprints on it by the time it was handed to you, or not. You tell me the scenarios. And I'm not looking for any teaser ideas of what's coming and stuff like that. But just from a writer's standpoint, coming into the frame, were you just given certain plot points and saying, you know, this is where we're leaving Superman, take over from here?
Mostly. In the case of Aquaman, it was particularly, Atlantis has been destroyed.
Right.
These particular characters are dead, although they didn't tell me when I started out that they were dead. I found that out from reading the comics. And we need a completely new approach. You know, I was pretty much told what the blown up status quo consisted of.
Gotcha.
And was able to build something out of the wreckage. In the case of Superman, Jeff is the architect of Crisis, and
right.
He's the co-writer of Up, Up, and Away. So you know, he told me, we're doing this, and this is where we start with the Return of Superman story in the Superman books. I was brought in on it. I think I was brought in on the Superman books before Jeff was, but since Jeff was already there on Crisis, he was the one who had set up all that stuff.
Sure.
I think there were probably one or two things that got put into Crisis or spun a particular way in Crisis because I said, you know, let's do this and we can do this in the Superman books. But for the most part, Crisis was all, you know, all worked out, all outlined, all underway by the time I got there on either book.
I'd like to move to Astro City. That's a subject, and also
rents there are terrible.
Yes, but I hear their cable system is excellent, so that's why. Older readers kind of flip in and flip out of comic books, and probably before you started writing, I'm sure you had your period where you weren't reading. Maybe you didn't.
No, I mean there were periods where I was disenchanted with some books or other books, but they're
you could always find something.
Yeah, I started reading comics when I was 14 years old.
Okay.
So it's not as if I was reading them since I was 8, and then when I was 15, I gave them up for girls and came back later. I started when I was 14, and I was interested in them, in the universes and the connections, and it wasn't very long thereafter before I decided I wanted to write these things for a living. And then when I got out of college, I did start writing them for a living, so even at times when I wasn't all that happy with the way mainstream books were going, I had to pay attention to them for research.
I gotcha.
But there are periods where, I can't get enough comics. I'm reading comics left and right, and then I'll go for 3 weeks. I don't want to read any comics.
Sure.
I'm still writing them, but, I want to read books about baseball or science fiction or whatever. It takes me a little while to get back into it. But that's like, you're talking about guys who quit on comics and come back 4 years later, and
right.
I'm talking about getting sick of comics for 3 weeks.
Because I was going to say, Astro City was one of those mid-90s books that really brought me back. That and your Marvels run, really, I mean, were two big examples of, wow, it's so nice to see this kind of writing in comics. It seems like it had been a couple years. And Astro City certainly did it for me, just because you took the archetypes, and it seemed in a lot of ways, and in a lot of ways now, that those stories are almost wish fulfillments of things you can do with archetypes because they're not Superman, Batman, and those characters, you can do whatever you want with them.
There are a lot of people out there who think that the Astro City characters are just my versions of specific superheroes, but they really never were. I mean, the Confessor is clearly inspired by Batman,
mm-hmm.
but what, you know, the place he comes from is from me hanging around with Scott McCloud when we're both like 16 years old and going, man, you know, there are all these superheroes out there, all Batman-derived. Well, I guess not all Batman-derived because it goes back to guys like The Shadow. Who are spooky, creepy, cloaked nighttime vigilantes. They're all trying to convince people they're Dracula. What if Dracula was trying to convince people he was a superhero? You know, he could dress up like a bat. He could do, you know, I think another friend of mine, Len Kaminsky, actually wrote Morbius for a little while, and his idea for Morbius was if Morbius goes around biting people and sucking their blood, that's a bad thing. But if he fights crime and he bites those guys and sucks their blood as punishment, well, then he's a hero, right? So Scott and I, when we were first talking about this back in the 1970s, we're just playing around with the idea that you have this whole class of superheroes, the spooky nighttime Avenger. What if one of them was a vampire and nobody knew it because, you know, he only shows up at night, he creeps around doing creepy things, he's got superpowers. All of these things describe vampires. And so when it came time to do this story, I was building the character off of that idea. It wasn't me going, I want to write a Batman story. How can I do a twist on it? It was me saying, I want to play around with the idea of the nighttime Avenger and the fact that they're spooky and shadowy and dark. And what if one of them's a vampire? The place Samaritan came from wasn't actually a Superman at all. It was a book called It was called Catapult, Me and Somebody Build a Siege Engine. And it's this cool little book about written by a guy named Jim Paul. And Jim got a federal arts grant to build a catapult to explore the artistic effect of flinging large, heavy things through the air. and the book goes through their efforts in, you know, building a catapult, figuring out how to do it, figuring out how to get the grant, doing, you know, experimenting. But they kept coming back to this idea of winging stuff through the air. And that had me thinking about flying and flying dreams. And again, McCloud, who is connected to a lot of this stuff, had been doing his 24-hour comics and was challenging people to do 24-hour comics. He was bugging me to do one. So I thought about doing one for a while. And I wanted to do one about this, you know, something about that idea of winging big heavy things through the air. And so I ended up asking myself the question, why would a superhero have flying dreams? You know, I used to have flying dreams when I was a kid, but if somebody who can actually do it, why would they do it? And the whole thing fell into place from there. So all Samaritan needed to be was flying hero with cape. I think I originally thought of him as there were these comic style magazine ads back in the 70s that Neil Adams drew featuring somebody named Captain Cash.
Yeah, yeah.
Explained how to use the newfangled teller machine. And he was just, I am Captain Cash. I have my cape. I have my big old chest. And I fly away at the end of the strip after explaining to people how they can use their cash machine. And I thought, yeah, it's him. Got to be heroic. He's got to have a cape. He's got to fly wicked fast. And everything fell in from there. So Astro City isn't about I want to do Superman or I want to do Batman. Astro City is about I want to do superheroes. And there are various classes and types of superheroes. Different kinds of groups, different kinds of individual heroes, different flavors. So I want to build the characters out of those archetypes rather than duplicating anything that's already there. As you've pointed out, I couldn't tell any of those stories with the existing Marvel and DC heroes anyway.
Sure. The it's funny though, because when the story doesn't revolve around the hero's perspective, when it is a citizen of Astro City, I've enjoyed those stories too, and it's that same vibe that you had going on in Marvels as well, and that is the people in the street looking up at the odd spectacle that's happening over in their skies, and how, you know, each of those, you know, watching those kind of events relate to them in their everyday life. And one in particular that I loved was, for lack of a better description, the Lois Lane-inspired Mort Weisinger story of the reporter trying to find the hero's identity. And just the wonderful twist of how things went in that relationship, as opposed to what we saw every month in Lois Lane, was just really fun to watch. And it really made for an amazing story, especially the interesting twist at the end. With the woman kind of becoming Rose Marie in her later life, for lack of a better description, and her daughter as well. And it was this really neat, poignant story of, wow, wouldn't it be wonderful for Superman to react the way the hero does to the Lois Lane archetype?
That, in fact, that was specifically inspired by Alex Ross saying, I want to do a story someday where some superhero who's in like a Superman Lois Lane type relationship, you know, she's always trying to expose his secret identity, and finally he just says, okay, you got me, you bitch. I'm done with this. Because you know, Alex found those stories so annoying. And for years we had that sort of on the docket of Astro City stories to do, but my problem with it is, man, that's mean. It's a story about a woman who acts like a pest until the hero gets sick of her and tells her off and leaves. That just feels like looking at the nasty side of things and not finding anything positive in there. And so I just played around with the story for years until I realized, no, this has to be the centerpiece of a story that's about what did this woman learn from this and what is she trying to pass on. And she's somebody who's the way she is because of the time she lived in.
Yes.
Her mother was somebody who had a taste of independence as a Rosie the Riveter type, and then when the men came back from war, lost it all, and instilled in her daughter the idea that you got to have everything yourself. You can't rely on someone else. And now, you know, she did the I can have everything, be everything, I can take on any challenge. And she saw the relationship as a challenge and broke it. And now she's telling her daughter, no, you've got to be softer, you've got to be more ready to compromise. And what she doesn't know is that in her era, the most she could be was the girlfriend. And in her daughter's era, the daughter can be the hero.
Yep.
So what the daughter is learning from her mother is about courage and dedication and stick-to-itiveness. While the mother is trying to say, don't make my mistakes, the daughter is saying, look how strong you were, Mom. I want to be half that strong. And that was what made it into a story that I thought was worth telling.
You bet. No, it's a beautiful story. And local heroes, all of your runs of Astro City have had individual issues like that, that really, you know, just 22 pages of a really neat, good compact story that gives you everything you need to appreciate it. And the one as well where the girl spends the summer in the farm town, and you get the farm town perspective on superheroes as opposed to the Astro City perspective. And again, there's just some, you know, really Rod Serling and kind of just honest, man. I really do. I it's Astro City is like the Twilight Zone for, you know, comics in terms of the way it's handled superhero anthology. Wonderfully eloquent stories that are done one and done that really show an interesting slice of life in a familiar superhero setting, but, you know, giving very human stories and very adult stories in 22 pages.
Oh, well, thank you. When I was pitching the series the first time, I was talking to people at different companies about it. And at that time, Lou Bank was at Dark Horse. Lou read the proposal, and his reaction to it was, "This is great. It's like Watchmen, but cheerful." I thought, it's not a bad description. But yeah, I've always been fascinated by the question of what else happens in a world that's got really strong genre conventions. What's it like to be the guy down the street? What's it like to watch this happen? What else happens in this kind of world? And I had done a couple of stories along those lines as backup stories in various Marvel books here and there, and then got to use it as the basis of Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
But I had, you know, at one point I talked to editors about doing a series called Marvel Superheroes, where Marvel Superheroes was a deli in the Baxter Building. They sold hero sandwiches. And every story, you'd see someone come in to get, you know, coffee and a bagel in the morning. And they'd head out into New York, and they'd have some sort of encounter with the superheroes that would affect their lives. And we would, we would see that kind of thing through the frame, through the setting of it always involves this sandwich shop somehow. And, editors laughed at me. And then I did Marvels, and Marvels was a big success in great, huge part due to Alex's artwork. But the way I tend to think of it, I think Alex's art made people pick it up, and the story made them pick up the next one.
Yeah, I would say so. And I would throw Brent in the mix, obviously, as well.
Yeah, but not on Marvels.
Oh, I see, as far as Marvels. Yeah, okay. I thought you meant for Astro City. But no, you're right.
But so after the success of Marvels, I thought, you know, maybe I really could do a regular series of this. And then I the more I thought about it, the more I realized, why do I need to do this for Marvel or DC, where they can own it and where if I get behind on the schedule, they can fire me and replace me with somebody else, when I could, you know, make it all up myself and be in complete control. And so Astro City came out of that.
Have you ever considered turning any Astro City stories to other writers?
No.
Okay.
I mean, aside from things like the few times we've talked about doing an Astro City TV series or cartoon or something,
mm-hmm.
that would have to be written by somebody else.
Certainly.
But in the comics, no, Astro City is mine. Anybody who's a good enough writer to write the kind of story I want to see in Astro City does not need Astro City. They can make up their own characters.
I understand, and many have.
So it's sort of like, we were talking before the interview, we were talking about Robert B. Parker and
yes.
Spencer. And, you know, who wants to see somebody else write Spencer?
No, I understand.
If somebody's good at writing tough, hard-boiled mystery detective guys, make up your own. Tell the story. You'll own it. And, Robert B. Parker can read it and go, that was good, but he doesn't have to edit it. He doesn't have to, you know, fit you into his continuity.
No, I got you. I understand. Would you ever want to be an editor yourself?
I have been an editor.
I thought you were, and I wasn't certain of that. Okay.
I edited 4 issues of a science fiction anthology called Open Space at Marvel in the late 80s.
Okay.
And I was also briefly, for about a year or so, the editor of, the assistant editor on Marvel Age Magazine, Marvel's in-house promo book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've done other sort of editorial jobs here and there. And I think that there was a time I would have liked it quite a bit. At this point in my life, I like writing stuff so much that I fear I would be one of those editors who says, do it my way.
Sure.
Instead of do it good.
No, I understand.
And I don't like editors like that, so I wouldn't want to be an editor like that. I'm happy enough working with guys like Jeff and Fabian and Roger when I'm co-writing something, where we know going into it one of us is the main writer, and the other guy is the guy who's helping out. So it's my job to say, write it the way I'd write it.
I understand. No, I understand. Which Roger, when you mentioned Roger?
Huh?
You mentioned Roger. Who?
Roger Stern.
Roger Stern. Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, Roger co-plotted Avengers Forever with me, and
okay.
He co-wrote a year's worth of Iron Man, he helped me out on Thunderbolts here and there. We're currently, he's writing Darkman versus the Evil Dead from my general story outline. You know, that's... you know, in that sort of situation, you always have the question of whose voice trumps. You know, when it's Avengers Forever, it's me. You know, Roger is there to help out and get the stuff done on time, but once his plot comes in, I'll mess with it until it's my plot.
Gotcha.
On Darkman versus the Evil Dead, it's a storyline I came up with, but it gets handed over to Roger to flesh out and realize, and it's got to be him. It's got to be his voice. And I'm the guy who's, like, support staff. In the case of me and Jeff on Up, Up, and Away, it's much more even, because we were able to come together and hash out that story together. We're both pulling in the same direction, and neither one of us is lead dog. We're co-dogs.
Is Darkman Evil Dead a new project, or is that something I missed?
It's in the works from Dynamite Comics.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I gather that's going to be coming out later this year.
It's wonderful.
It's a four-issue miniseries that, like I said, Roger's writing it from my story outline, and James Fry is doing the art.
Cool.
It's looking great.
Man, good to see Roger back. I would imagine, now you had that amazing run as well on Avengers, and so many important arcs that came from it. Could you still return? Do you still have more ideas for either what now makes up the Avengers, or do you envision a time where you would get back to the Avengers and still have new Avengers stories to tell?
Well, anything's possible, and like James Bond says, never say never. I'm not familiar with what the Avengers are doing now. I find that once I've been writing a book for a long time, it's hard to slip back into the shoes of reader.
I understand.
I end up reading it from the point of view of somebody going, well, that's not what I would have done. And that's not what I would have done is not a valid critical reaction.
Sure.
So I'm sure at some point, once it's been long enough, I'll read through what's been doing in Avengers and be able to react to it like a reader. But I'm just not at that stage yet. And I have other Avengers stories that I could do that I'd like to do someday. I don't know if they'd fit with the new approach. I don't know if we'll ever get back to that point. But, you know, I also know that I wrote Avengers for 5 years.
Yes.
That may be long enough. You know,
well, and a lot of great stories. A lot of, like, really popular arcs that are still, I'm sure, selling very well in trade.
I'm very glad people have reacted to it that way. But, you know, basically what I'm saying is if I was to be working back at Marvel again, I might have more fun spending 5 years writing Fantastic Four or Thor or Doctor Strange or X-Men and being able to do for them the kind of thing I did for Avengers. And if I do enough of those, you know, spend 3-4 years writing Commandees, do this, do that, I'll eventually be old and die. And I have plenty of stuff to do in between now and then that'll keep me busy. So if I never get back to Avengers, that's not a big hardship. If I do, then yeah, there's stuff I could do.
I wanted to ask about JLA Avengers. Are you happy with the way the four issues turned out? I thought it was a great story, and I thought George's art was beautiful, and I think you had an amazingly tough task because the 20 years that I think people were waiting for George Perez's, you know, project to come to fruition, there was a lot of hype and a lot of anticipation of what it could be, and plus all the characters that you had to juggle and give everyone their moments, I think you achieved a lot in those four issues.
Well, thanks. My one regret about JLA Avengers, the one thing that I would have wanted is, give me twice as many pages. Take every single issue we had and make it, at least 80 pages long, if not 96, just give us the room to sprawl all over the place. The fact that it was 20 years in the making, that it was something that became the legendary lost project, was the thing that enabled us to spend 200 pages on it in the first place. I mean, when it originally was going to come out, it was going to be a 48-page story.
Wow.
So it was the fact that it had this reputation that put a lot of pressure on us to deliver on something that would be worth waiting 20 years for, but it also made it such a big project that it was, it was worth getting done, and it was worth doing with George, and it was worth doing right. As far as all the characters go, that's partially George, in that, whenever you ask George which characters do we want to use, his answer is literally all of them. that's me too. You've read my Avengers, right?
Sure.
I kept a lot of characters in there at
you
virtually all times. So the challenge of doing a story that does feature every JLA member ever and every Avengers member ever is part of the fun. Would I have liked more room for the Thor Superman fight and for the big slam-ang-ang-ang-ang at the end? Then you bet. But I think we did pretty well with the space we had.
The other great thing about those four issues, too, is you're so aware of the story environment as well, because the throwaway lines of the Marvel characters being in the DCU and looking around and saying, everything's so clean. And just almost disgusted with how clean everything is. And wait a minute, the people admire you? It was those kind of distinctions and being aware of the difference between the Marvel Universe and the DC Universe. And again, God, Astro City, literally you've written the map several times and the A to Z guide and so many details of Astro City minutiae. I mean, if it isn't a real place, it certainly could be built to one, as one to your specifications. And I think that is just something that readers really latch onto and appreciate.
I think that's just, part of it. It's just me. I mean, in the case of JLA Avengers, we wanted to do something more than let's have a couple of 900-foot-tall guys standing over here and our heroes have to fight them, and it's all a big roller coaster ride. We wanted to do all that, but we wanted to have something else to sink our teeth into, to give it some more depth. And Tom Brevoort and I, talking it over, decided that, this should be what DC feels like versus what Marvel feels like. Not, we are the Avengers, so we are the Justice League of our universe, and you are the Avengers of your universe, and we're really all the same. They're not. What's different about them? What's different about their world? Since 1985 or so, I think that the DC Universe has gotten a lot more like the Marvel Universe,
mm-hmm.
but still, we went with reputation, and the DC Universe is a shiny, happy place where superheroes get museums. and the Marvel Universe is a place where, they're not as powerful, and they fight harder, and mobs with torches and pitchforks chase them around, that's their great strength because it makes them more human and more conflicted and more troubled. So let's play that off of each other. In the case of Astro City, I want people to believe that city. I find it's spilling over to Superman because as I've been writing Superman, I've been, there were times I'm calling up my editors and going, I want a map of Metropolis. I need a map of Metropolis. I need to know as much about it as I can. And I ended up with a role-playing game supplement, the Atlas of the DC Universe and the Daily Planet Guide to Metropolis. And it's just so useful to me to know what's been established and what I can make up. In an issue that hasn't come out yet, we see the Metropolis' equivalent of Madison Square Garden. And I mentioned in the intro caption that basketball season is just recently over, and the the Metropolis Generals didn't make the playoffs as usual. And that's just that sort of little touch is the kind of thing that, that makes you believe the world. You know, yeah, Metropolis's baseball team does well and their basketball team sucks. You know, if there had been a long history of Metropolis General stories in which they'd won championship after championship, I'd want to know about that, so I didn't say, oh, yeah, they're out of the playoffs as usual. And I got lots of letters from people going, what, you haven't been paying attention? But I love to be able to work with that stuff, to make the setting seem as real as possible, because the realer it feels, the more you believe it when they're flying around in the sky and smacking the crap out of each other.
Absolutely.
If you can believe in the sidewalk, then the spectacle looks truer.
That's cool. Is Aerosmith something you're going to return to?
Yes.
That's great.
It's, in fact, it's contracted. We're going to do at least one more miniseries, and
okay.
We'd like to do more beyond that. The trouble is DC seems to want Carlos to do their big shiny heroes, and you know, he likes doing that too. So it's a matter of getting enough of that stuff under his belt so that he can take, you know, 8 or 9 months off from that and do another round of Aerosmith. So, you know, my big triumph, at least this year, is now when Carlos does the big shiny DC superheroes, I get to write them. So I'm not waiting for Carlos and wishing I could work with him on Aerosmith. I'm working with him on Superman, and we're awaiting the time in his schedule that we could do another round of Aerosmith. But yes, we will get to it.
That's cool. That was a great World War One story, and I enjoyed the combination of magic and in the World War One kind of flyer setting, and everything was a lot of fun.
Thanks.
You've got to be a big history buff, given all the different historic kind of notes you put, again, in things like Astro City as well, where clearly some of the history city is inspired by other cities' histories as well.
Well, you'd think I'd be a history buff.
No?
I'm interested in history. The place Aerosmith came from, at least history-wise, was back when Dark Horse was publishing a comic adapting the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles TV show. They hired me to write historical text pieces in the back explaining, you know, oh, so in this episode, Indy met a young George Patton and General Pershing. Who the hell are they anyway?
Gotcha.
So I did a ton of research for that, and I ended up for one of the issues writing a text piece on how World War One got started. And that got me interested in, boy, that was an interesting turning point for Western civilization and class structure and all these different things. And so that was sitting around in the back of my head when I was looking for something I could do with Carlos that would have lots of fantastic visual aspects to it and be a really interesting world. So the idea of taking that and mixing fantasy into it was what got us there. But I immediately turned to Lawrence Watt Evans, a friend of mine who's a fantasy novelist, and said, please build this history for me. I know what I want it to be, but I have no idea how to get there.
No kidding.
So actually for the second Aerosmith series, which takes place behind enemy lines, I'm doing a ton of research because I don't know what Germany and Austria were like in the latter parts of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century. And once they have Aerosmith running around in towns and cities that are built out of that, I'd better know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm starting by reading histories of the world, and then I'm going to narrow it down to Europe and then to Germany. And then
wow.
So by the time I'm done writing Aerosmith, I'll know an enormous amount of history, but right now I'm kind of an interested amateur.
Well, so good job so far, because again, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I was going to, the idea of class structure, very, very heavily influenced in or very a big part of the story in Aerosmith. And I think you handle it very well, and it is an interesting conflict, area of conflict for stories.
Well, when we get to the third or fourth Aerosmith miniseries, the October Revolution, and we get to see magic and communists in Moscow, that should be a lot of fun.
That's really cool. What else is coming up for you?
Well, I'm doing Superman with Carlos, so after Up, Up, and Away, we launch on a story that involves a brand new villain called Subject 17, and the strangest and least likely reappearance of Arion, Lord of Atlantis, that you could imagine.
Cool.
Shenanigans at LexCorp and mysteries from outer space and lots of big fun. So between Superman and Action Comics and Aquaman, that pretty much fills a lot of my schedule. I've still got some Conan stuff coming out.
Oh, okay, good.
That'll be wrapping up. And Astro City, we have a new Astro City special in June featuring Samaritan and his greatest foe, Infidel, that Brent is drawing now, and I have to say it's one of the best scripts I've ever written.
Cool.
After that, we'll do the Dark Age book 2, and that certainly feels like a lot of work to me.
You bet. Do you have a ballpark time of when Dark Age 2 might be starting?
We're shooting for September.
Very cool. Kurt, listen, I've taken you more than an hour, and I don't want to take more of your time. There's always more to talk to you about, given your body of work. So I hope down the road we will be able to, you know, talk again and explore some other Kurt Busiek stories.
Sounds good to me.
That's Kurt Busiek. Check out Aquaman, Sword of Atlantis, and Superman from DC Comics. And later this summer, more Astro City coming from Wildstorm. And that'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to WordBalloon.com for updates on upcoming episodes. WordBalloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2006.